Welcome to the Center for the Study of Global Governance public debate. Tonight's debate on the global justice movement and critique of free trade is part of promotional activities of the Center's new edition of Global Civil Society Yearbook. Some of you may have seen the book. This is, as I said, the third one. And in this book, there is a chapter by one of our speakers tonight, Yahya Said and Lord Magna Desai, on trade and global civil society. The timing of tonight's debate is well chosen. It comes at a time when the social forum has just ended and we have the economic forum as we speak, I suppose. We have a very interesting panel tonight, which I hope will be provocative enough, and we will, so that we can have a lively discussion. I will introduce each panelist as they speak. They will each speak for about 10 minutes, and I would kindly ask you to keep the time so that we can have enough time for discussion. We'll start tonight's discussion by Yahya Said, who is a research officer at the Center for the Study of Global Governance. Yahya is both an academic and activist with a long experience in activism in Czech Republic and various other parts of the former Eastern Bloc. Yahya, please.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, my co-author, Magna Desai, is not here, so I'll be speaking on behalf of the two of us. This chapter in the yearbook about trade and global civil society is the second. Yes, the chapter that we wrote in last year's yearbook on global civil society is the second on the so-called anti-capitalist movement or global justice and solidarity movement. The first one appears. Excuse me? That's not to me. It's switched on, right? Yeah. Okay. So this is a second in a series of three chapters about the global justice and solidarity movement. The first one we wrote for the first yearbook, and it was about money, the anti-capitalist movement and money. Or global civil society and money. This one is about trade, and the third one that we hope to produce in a year's time will be about global civil society and labor, the anti-capitalist movement and labor. And thus we hope to cover three of the main aspects, if you like, three of the main economic flaws that global civil society deals with. When we first wrote the first chapter, that was soon after Seattle, and there was lots of question marks about the global justice movements. Today, at that time, it was almost unknown. There were many people in the mainstream, if you like, of economics and politics were surprised by this movement that they never heard before, that kind of burst into the scene in Seattle and then sustained a high level of activism for the years to come. Today, as we produced the second chapter, the movement was a much larger and much more both known and influential. And we hope that the movement will still be there when we write the third chapter. Although the chapter, for those of you who read it, our second chapter, is much less positive about the movement and its prospects and how it's keeping in touch with the times, if you like. Last year, which was full of events, as you well appreciate, one of the enduring images of last year was that of trade negotiators, I believe the Brazilian and the South African trade negotiators, exchanging hugs to celebrate the collapse of the Cancun trade talks, the WTO ministerial meeting in Cancun. And it's kind of provided a fitting surreal image for a year full of those. It was quite bizarre to see two trade negotiators celebrate the collapse of a process that they have been engaging with. It didn't feel right. It also didn't provide enough feeling to celebrate this as a victory for the Third World or the anti-capitalist movement, because one couldn't help but feel that the U.S. and Europe meant for these talks to fail. I mean, the ridiculous positions taken up by the United States on cotton or by the EU on agricultural subsidies could have in no way been accepted by Third World leaders. And there was, you know, one couldn't help but feel that there was an intent on all sides to make these negotiations fail. So it was a bizarre victory, and one couldn't really feel, you know, decide what one felt about it. I mean, how was that failure, how was that collapse in Cancun going to be beneficial to people in the Third World, to the poor people all around the world? It was one could not get a clear reading on that. And exactly the question that immediately the day after these celebrations of the collapse of Cancun was, and now what? What's the future? What's the alternative? How are we going to move on from here? How is the world a better place now that the WTO has been derailed, as many of the activists were calling for? Indeed, what was happening the next day was that the U.S. administration was moving on at a rapid pace with bilateral deals that completely bypass the multilateral WTO process, with Singapore, Jordan, Australia, and eventually moving on to more significant partners. And these deals, these bilateral deals, as many of the activists are well aware of, are much more onerous than the WTO, and the U.S. is succeeding to get much more bigger concessions from these third world countries by negotiating with them on a bilateral basis. The reality of the matter is, of course, despite all these worries and questions about the collapse of Cancun, is that it was a culmination, if you like, of sorts, to the struggle of the anti-capitalist movement over the last 3-4 years. Movement that has been obscure, as I've mentioned before, in 1999, has suddenly became the mainstream. It has succeeded, most importantly, in attacking and defeating its main target, the Washington Consensus. One can hardly speak of Washington Consensus today. There is with a administration in the United States and many of the administrations in Europe as well, opposed to the very idea of consensus, administrations that are unilateralist by nature. Yet the movement seems to be sort of lost touch with this development, and is still fighting a consensus that is not there. It's still fighting an enemy that has been it's fighting with a reality that has shifted. It has not. There's a feeling that there's a understanding of the developments that happened after September 11 and the ascent of the Bush administration in the United States. Another thing that was disconcerting about the activism around the WTO last year was that it's the same demonstrators who were calling for multilateralism in their when they demonstrated about Iraq, who were calling for a bigger role for the UN, for more international legitimacy, are fighting against multilateralism when it comes to global trade, because they're fighting the only organization within the multilateral system where the U.S. can be actually defeated. It can be challenged by a country like Costa Rica or the Philippines or Singapore, and actually be defeated and pay penalties or adjust its trade policy. And one thing that we have discovered in analyzing the development of the movement and why has this come to pass, is that there has been a radicalization. Obviously, the movement seems to have taken the bait of the what we call the regressive unilateralist U.S. administration, and has taken even more radical positions on trade and on many of the issues addressed. When you talk to activists in the late 90s and early in 2001, very few would talk about abolishing multilateral institutions. Many would call for reform. Many would call for engagement with the World Bank and the WTO. Increasingly over the last year or two, there has been call for outright abolition of these organizations. Yet, if you look at that process in combination with increasing unilateralism by governments both on both sides of the Atlantic, one cannot see how this could benefit the main constituencies of this movement, or the main constituency that the movement seems to be advocating the interests of. I think one of the developments that have led to this situation, that this movement that seemed in 99, 2000 seemed to be like this, to represent the spirit of the time, if you like, and capture the main concerns of people across the globe, concerns about globalization, concerns about social justice and environmental issues. We tried to answer this question of why did this happen? Why has it all of a sudden come to represent policies that are so out of touch with realities after September 11? And one of the reasons is the structure of the movement itself. I mean, it started as a very, if you like, non-hierarchical movement, a movement without leaders, a movement without without a little red book, without a Bible. But instead of sustaining that really has translated at the end of the day. And as we see often at social forums, for example, the one that took place last year in Porto Alegre or recently in Mumbai, is that leaders still float to the top and ideas still float to the top, but completely unconnected or disconnected with the bulk of the movement. If you go to many of these gatherings of the movement, whether it's social fora or other gatherings, you see a big disconnection between the mass of the people, the foot soldiers of the movement, who are quite free-thinking and radical and young, and the people who sit at the podiums, who are usually old left representatives, rehashing ideas that we have heard a lot many times before and are actually implicitly rejected by the bulk of the movement. I think an example of that could be seen, I've heard recently from one of the latest demonstrations on Iraq, with one of the demonstrators saying, "Not in my name, not in my name," i.e. not in my name the war, and not in my name the speaker speaking from the podium. And it's exactly the same picture you see in the social fora too. You have this radical body, this dynamic body, and people like Noam Chomsky, for whom I have a lot of respect, but Noam Chomsky cannot possibly be right today if he was right so many years before, and he's still saying the same stuff. If you like, the informal nature of the movement and its attempt to reject leadership and reject it, fall in the traps of the old anti-capitalist movements across the centuries or across the years, seems to have backfired and resulted again in some opportunist leaders coming to the top, be it old left politicians, old spent old left politicians or policymakers, or new nationalists like Chavez or the leaders of India or South Africa, who are really not necessarily concerned with the plight of the masses of the third world and are more pursuing national interests, and using the movement, leveraging this great international cross-border movement as a platform, as a springing board to achieve narrow nationalist interests. To end at a completely negative note, I think there's a tension between, if you like, the grassroots of the anti-capitalist movement and the people who have somehow ended up being at the top of it, representing it, speaking on its behalf. And unless there's a resolution to that by the movement generating or producing its own leaders and its own ideas, it will be very difficult to write this third chapter of the trilogy in 2 years' time. Thank you.
Thank you, Yahya. We haven't agreed on a particular order in which the speakers will speak, but since we started with Yahya, who is an academic and activist, I think we could move to the gentleman on my right, who is more on an activist end of the arena. Our next speaker is Mr. Stuart Wallace, who is director of New Economics Foundation. This is a new radical think tank spanning economics, environment, and society. Prior to becoming the director of New Economics Foundation, Mr. Stuart was with the Oxfam for about 11 years. Most of that time, he worked as Oxfam's international director and was very much involved in Oxfam trade campaign.
Please. Thanks. How's that hearing? Can you hear me okay? Okay, great. Just somebody wave at me if it starts going off again. What I want to do, because I've literally only been at the New Economics Foundation 8 weeks, and I'm actually trying in my own head to put together the Oxfam reformist view of what's happening on trade and what needs to happen on trade with a much more radical environmentalist view coming from New Economics Foundation, which is a bit that's been missed out quite often from the discourse of the development agencies. And I actually think that fault line is quite important because it actually represents some of the reasons why there is also a split in the global justice movement between those who might be characterized as reformists and those who might be characterized as abolitionists. And I want to give you, before I get into that, a bit of flavor, more from a human side, why this whole trade issue matters. Now, many of you know all about that, but I think it's worth going back to why there is so much anger in the world about what is happening with the world trading system and putting a human face to it, because that's what it's about. And I think I need to position that to then get into what's the way forward. Now, my conclusions, just to go to the end, are going to be very much that this is not the time to give up the fight for a multilateralist system. I think absolutely we need that. We also need a much greater focus on localism at the local level. It's not one or the other, it's both those things. But this is absolutely, post-Cancun, the time to fight to make the WTO a different type of organization, because actually, for the first time, as I'll show, things have moved in the developing country favor. But let me start with trade. The Oxfam position on trade is that trade of the right type can be a massive force for poverty reduction. I'll come back to what right type means. And arguably, trade has played quite a part in one of the biggest lifting of people out of the poverty, with all sorts of other downsides. Let's not go into that now. But what's happened in China, about 120 million people lifted out of China, out of poverty in the 90s, trade has played a part in that. Trade also, if you look at places like Vietnam and Uganda, you've seen an increase in agriculture exports being accompanied by improvements in food security and improvements in domestic food production. So the two don't necessarily be in opposition. There are ways to square the circles. They're not always easy, but there are ways. But the main thing you have to look at is over the same decade of the 90s, if you look at the poorest 5% in the world, their incomes in real terms have gone down 25%. The richest 5%, their incomes have gone up by 12%. And we're looking at trade at the minute being one part of a desperately unjust system, a system that, if anything, is getting more unjust. And if you're a small farmer, as I'll tell you a couple of stories in a minute, in a developing country, you don't face a level playing field, big joke. You face a vertical and unclimbable cliff, let's be blunt, in most cases. And that's for all sorts of reasons, but it's this horrible, lethal concoction of subsidies and dumping, you know, $1 billion a day going in subsidies. Barriers to developing country exports, even of the right type, costing another $100 billion a year. Forcing open of poor country markets. Haiti is four times more open in trade barrier terms than the US. Haiti, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, it's ludicrous. The ongoing crisis in primary commodities, for all sorts of reasons. Not only has there been a long-term downward trend because of dumping and many other factors, there's also concentration of power at the higher ends of the market, which means that farmers get less and less of the value that is in that market. And there's been rapid liberalization of certain markets. All those combine, again, in a lethal cocktail. And then you've got the disgrace of what's been happening on trips. Many of you know the HIV, AIDS, drugs, many other factors I can't go into now. And you've got the whole question of trying to force through new agreements on investment, etc. So when you see that picture, you can understand why there is so much anger out there and why one of the things that gives fuel to the whole global justice movement. And just to tell you a couple of stories, met last year with Brahima Utara, who's a cotton farmer in Burkina Faso. Brahima has a family of about four kids, a half an acre of cotton under cultivation, and was really at that time, and unfortunately I don't know the end of the story, but I probably isn't good, was facing the issue of what the crop prices he was going to get for his cotton this year, because on that depended whether his kids could go to school, whether he could pay his medical bills, and whether in the end he would have enough to eat for his family. And he was up against the factor that 25,000 US cotton farmers are getting subsidies of $4 billion a year. That works out $150,000 per cotton farmer. And it's no wonder the US is the biggest exporter of cotton, even though it's not got the right conditions to grow cotton in compared to many other parts of the world. It's a crazy, absolutely bluntly crazy and unjust. So there's that guy, and you look at the cost to West African farmers alone, it's something like $200 million in lost sales, lost profits. That's sort of what we estimate. Or sit down with the discussions we had also last year with some farmers from Kenya and from Honduras, both involved in maize and coffee. Coffee at a 100-year low for all sorts of reasons. Maize prices, again, very low in both countries. In Honduras, also facing US dumping of maize. And they were saying, well, where do we go? We need to get out of these crops. Yeah, everybody's telling us to diversify. That's what they all say. Oh, come on, where? Sugar. Well, there's massive barriers, 70% barriers to sugar for most developing countries into Europe. Again, Europe's the largest exporter of sugar in the world. Massive subsidies, again, doesn't make sense. No, we can't do that. What about peanuts? Well, can't export into the US market because the massive barriers there. And you go around these agriculture commodities that people should have a comparative advantage, and they're stuffed, absolutely stuffed. So that's where the energy comes from. But a more positive note, we did quite a lot of work in Oxfam and many other people, working with southern organizations to get signatures, get people out on the streets campaigning for fairer trade, a fairer world. And in addition, many of us went with southern organizations to see different trade ministers. And I had an hour and a half meeting with Arun Jaitley, the trade minister of India. And I don't quite take your view that they're taking just a nationalist view. We were discussing the issue of could there be common ground between India and Brazil and China. And he was saying yes with China and no with Brazil. And we were saying what the activists were saying in Brazil. And I actually see what happened at Cancun in one way being a success story, that southern nations got together and actually said, no, we're not going to play the old game. And what the trade negotiators of the North actually went in, not wanting it to fail, but they went in playing the wrong poker. They'd been used to a poker game in back room doors, and they'd been used to just pushing one off against the other, and suddenly they found they couldn't. And that's why there was such anger at what happened at Cancun amongst the European Union or the US, because they played the wrong game. They didn't learn. And that's why I would also say this is actually a good moment, because, you know, arguably we won the battle, but we lost the war if all that happens is a retreat back to bilateral methods, because for all the reasons Yahid's saying, it's the wrong way. But I actually think potentially we can also win the war, because there is a chance of getting people together, and people out on the streets in Bangladesh, in India, make a difference, and governments of those democracies actually do have to listen. So, and they do want to listen, because it fits with some of their agendas. It's not all negative. So I actually think there is a chance now to build on that and to push for that multilateral system to really work in the way it ideally ought to. Just one quick aside. One of the things we used as a campaigning tool for Cancun was giant heads. Some of you may have seen pictures in the paper of these giant heads of different leaders sitting by the pool with their hands in their ears, not listening to the people. Well, we had to import those giant heads to Mexico via Miami. And unfortunately, quite worrying for a moment, George Bush's head got impounded by US Customs. And the reason they gave us was it contained excessive vegetable matter. So I thought that was quite suitable. But just to go finally then to put the more environmental picture onto this whole picture, I think one of the reasons there are other people saying let's reject the WTO is the concern around the environment. And there's no doubt that for some crops, for some products, it's daft. Something like, there was a Sustain, some of you may have seen in the Observer on Sunday, Sustain was estimating that the average Sunday lunch in the UK travelled 26,000 miles to get to our plates between beans, Thai chicken, various other things. Pretty crazy, isn't it? When we could grow those products in our own country. And the UK exports 126 million litres of milk and imports, no, the other way around actually, imports 126 million litres of milk and exports 270 million litres of milk. Does that make sense? So, yes, of course we need to put food security, local food security first. Of course we need to look at the environmental costs of transport, and that's a whole campaign that needs to come in. But that doesn't mean there aren't some things, take sugar, coffee, cocoa, or those sort of products, that should be exported from developing countries. And we do need the trade barriers to come down. It's not one or the other. And I think we're getting stuck in a not clever enough argument around this environmentalist versus trade. There are good, if we could get the right costs in there, there are good conditions for both. So I come back to saying, finally, there is only one thing worse than the current multilateral rules, and that would be no multilateral system at all, because I really do think that would go back to the situation of giving power to the backroom deals and to the big muscle of the Americans and others. So I think now's the time to keep a cool nerve and really fight for a better multilateral system. And I think that's really what I want to leave you with. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Let's take a full turn back to theory. Dr. Razem Sali is a senior lecturer at the London School of Economics. He teaches international political economy.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Good. As one of the LSE's sort of in-house WTO specialists, there's a lot I could say on the policy detail of what happened before Cancun, at Cancun itself, and afterwards. But I'd like to leave that for discussion and pick up on one or two things that were said by the two previous speakers. Let me stick in my allotted 10 minutes to some very, very broad propositions on the broader debate of trade, globalization, policy choice, what is coming from NGOs and others. Now, I suppose I've been wheeled in here to make the case for free trade, and I'm quite happy to do that, as I usually do. It's something that can be defended, as the economist conventionally defends it, in terms of what Adam Smith called the wealth of nations, and the wealth of nations all round. Edwin Cannon, who was the first professor of political economy at the LSE, called free trade a way of rendering mutual service. It is a matter of all-round gain, first in terms of specialization according to comparative advantage. And comparative advantage, yes, still does apply or should apply to trade between developed and developing countries. But that's just the preface or the prelude to the longer-run gains from commercial openness in terms of technology transfer, the signaling effect in terms of foreign direct investment, very important. If you open the border to trade, you open the border or you show that you're more welcoming to FDI. That boosts domestic savings rates. It boosts capital accumulation. Freer trade does reap economies of scale through wider markets. That brings about productivity gains. There is the possibility, the stimulative effect again, for technology transfer and so on. This is not just a matter of developed countries, it's a matter of developing countries too. That's the conventional economic argument, but one shouldn't forget two other arguments, one political and the other arguably moral. On the political side, the 19th century argument was that free trade was also a way of helping to keep government reasonably limited and clean, as opposed to overactive and corrupt. And I think that argument applies as much today. At the international level, if one follows the vein of thinking from Richard Cobden through to Cordell Hull, free trade, while not necessarily guaranteeing peace, it didn't in 1914, is nevertheless part of a wider package of policies that can help keep the peace, as opposed to a descent into poisonous and eventually warlike international relations. I mean, the record of history is that tit-for-tat protectionism can lead to some very nasty things, whereas free-ish trade can help keep the peace. Finally, there is the libertarian argument, which is often neglected by the ivory tower economists these days. Free trade is part of the argument of free markets. It is about individual liberty and the freedom to choose, so that individuals can lead more varied and interesting lives, partly through becoming more prosperous. Now, all these arguments, particularly that link between free trade and between wealth and liberty, are things that Adam Smith was very aware of and did enunciate, but perhaps some of those arguments are less visible today. All of this, of course, is in the abstract, but as some people might say, let's get real here. One has to match that up with the historical record and with telling examples from the past and the present. Now, to me, the historical as well as the more recent evidence is overwhelming. There is no country in the world that has had a sustained rise in real incomes without being open to the world. Openness is not a panacea, but it is very much part of that wider package. It's true of ancient times, it was true of the Middle Ages, it's been true since the Industrial Revolution, and that goes for developing countries too, during the colonial period and especially after. If one looks at the post-war evidence for developed countries and for developing countries, the evidence is overwhelming. Countries that have opened more to the world, including developing countries, have grown more, have seen increases in real income, and that has translated indirectly into reductions in poverty. China is the emblematic example. There are those who are as blind as bats who attribute success to China more to selective industrial intervention than to trade liberalization. I say they are blind because while China clearly engages in sectoral intervention here and there, the liberalization, both internal and external, has been massive. The most massive the world has ever seen, and that has helped in delivering significant results. Now, all of that is not to say that this is some kind of panacea. Of course, it's very complicated. When it comes to issues of how you sequence your opening to trade and investment with other aspects of policy, how fast or how slow you do it, how you relate it to institutions, which is really key, These are very complicated matters, and there is no fixed blueprint. This is perhaps the fallacy of the Washington consensus as seen from some of the Washington institutions, that one can have something that's reasonably uniform across the world. It doesn't work that way. But there are broad maxims, and I think openness as part of a wider package does deliver the goods. Let me say a few things about policy and civil society, so-called. There is the argument about global governance. Now, it may be the wrong venue to say this, but I think global governance is just hot air. There is no such thing. There is national governance, and then there is imperial governance. We know where that comes from these days. But global governance is for the birds. The situation now is not too different from what it was in the 19th century. Ultimately, the key policy choices are made by the nation state, either good or bad. Of course, international organizations and international forms of cooperation are more important now than they were 100 years ago. But two things. First, one shouldn't exaggerate their importance, just as one shouldn't exaggerate the effect of aid. It can be good at the margin, here or there. No. Secondly, international organizations, in terms of thought as well as action, particularly within the UN system, have done a lot of bad over the post-war period. I can elaborate if you like afterwards. Something about so-called civil society, and let me repeat what I said as far as global governance is concerned. I don't think there is any such thing as global civil society. To me, that is a utopian concept. I try to follow George Orwell's injunction by choosing my terms carefully. Civil society is a term that arose during the commercial revolution in the West. It was the emergence of middle classes who were there to uphold bourgeois values and expand commercial society. Civil society, as it has been construed and propagated by certain organizations today, is about anti-liberal, anti-market groups, many of them highly organized and highly funded in the West, who do not believe in the values of commercial openness, let alone bourgeois civilization. Uncivil society may be perhaps a more accurate term for some than civil society. But let me give you my take on what I think are some of the trends that come from those who are very skeptical of markets and globalization. There has always been a root and branch critique of globalization. That, of course, came particularly from the communist system before the Berlin Wall came down. And then, of course, there were the fellow travelers before 1989, who did their best to undermine markets and the values of the West. Now, that has not disappeared. It has changed form. There are plenty of NGOs out there who do not understand markets and who try their best to undermine markets and the institutions that underpin them. John Stuart Mill referred to the sentimental enemies of political economy. We still have those sentimental enemies. They are sometimes in alliance, witting or unwitting, with the unsentimental enemies of political economy, namely the interested enemies of free trade who want to defend monopoly profits. They could be steel companies in the US, they could be agricultural monopolies in Indonesia. Martin Wolf, in a recent article in the FT, called it the nexus, the alliance between Mumbai and Davos. Well, it exists. But it's not something that one can really pigeonhole in terms of a wacko extremist minority. There is, shall we say, a broad feeling out there. One finds it in NGOs, one finds it in the UN system, even among corporate leaders, that markets don't work, and that somehow or other, collectivist arrangements globally have to be devised, involving big business, NGOs, unions, governments, international organizations, to intervene in markets left, right, and center. David Henderson, the former chief economist of the OECD, calls it the new millennium collectivism, or global salvationism, deliverance from above. We had a speech here by Mark Malik Brown, the administrator of the UNDP, a couple of years ago, which was very much in that vein. It was global corporatist deliverance from above. I'm going to stop here, but let me, to summarize, to encapsulate, say this. There are the time-old or the timeless arguments in favor of free trade for both developed and developing countries. I'm perfectly happy to defend that in terms of the historical record and of the situation today. I think fundamentally it's a matter of national policy choice. What happens at the international or global level can be of second-line assistance, or it can be unhelpful. And thirdly, when it comes to those who are against, not free trade tomorrow, as though one is having it like manna from heaven, but something that is politically feasible and practicable. Those who are against it, my position is don't try and be third way-ish and mealy-mouthed about it, because I think that is both intellectually dishonest and practically counterproductive, but rather stand up, make a clear and reasonably simple case in the spirit of civilized confrontation. Thank you.
Thank you. Our last speaker is Mr. Adam Lent. He is a research fellow at the Fabian Society and co-author of recently published pamphlet Progressive Globalization.
stand and think. I'm pompous enough to stand and try and project rather than speak through a microphone. I think I disagree so fundamentally with what's just been said in so many ways that I almost feel like just responding to that, but I think I'll leave it to the floor because I'm sure that I have plenty to say about that. Working for the Fabian Society, which of course is the bastion historically in Britain of state interventionism and social democracy, inevitably would have a lot to say in response to that, but we'll leave that to later. I wanted just to focus on something slightly different to what the other speakers have looked at, and that's the role of the global justice movement in northern countries. In recent years, last couple of years, there's been a focus, quite rightly, on the way the global justice movement has really taken off in southern countries, in the developing world, and that is very significant. But I think it's also important to think about the role the global justice movement has in the north, in the wealthy and economically developed countries. And why is that? Well, firstly, it's because that's quite clearly where power lies globally at the moment. Militarily, economically, politically, the vast bulk of power exists within the G8 nations currently. Secondly, the southern protest movement, for how significant and important it is, which undoubtedly is no really major threat to the votes of G8 governments, and nor really is it a major threat to the economies of G8 governments, because the vast wealth-producing international trade still occurs between wealthy nations rather than between north and south. And then finally, I would say it's very important to look at that because I think historically movements always overestimate their own power and their own significance. There's always a strong element in movements which thinks they can build things from the ground up, from scratch. And the truth is, when you look at the history of movements, which has been my academic part for years to look at how movements work, they always end up having to compromise and cooperate and negotiate with established power structures if they're ever going to bring about really significant change. Even the most revolutionary movements have actually ended up doing that in the end. However, if we do look at the global justice movement in the north, we can see that really over the last few years it has had relatively little impact on the political agenda, particularly when you compare it, for example, to the big grassroots movements of the 1960s and 1970s, the peace movement, the anti-racist movement, the women's movement, the green movement. These were all movements that have really, over a period of 15 to 20 years, really changed the agenda of debate within wealthy, developed countries. The globalization movement has really not had an impact in the north. Close to comparable to that yet. Of course, it's a younger movement, but even for its period of existence so far, I think it's had little impact compared to those movements. So the important then question then is, why has it had such little impact? And for me, I think that comes down to a vision here. The type of vision that the global justice movement is promoting in the north, in northern countries. Firstly, the clearest vision that has come out from more radical elements within the global justice movement, the anti-globalizers, the localizers, the revolutionary socialists. And to tell the truth, these radical visions simply aren't credible for the vast mass of people across the wealthy northern countries at the moment. The level of affluence within the G8 countries is obviously extremely high compared to the rest of the world, and that affluence relies fundamentally on the successful, smooth operation of the global economy. So the vast mass of people in northern wealthy countries simply aren't going to be attracted to visions which call for the fundamental overthrow of global economic structures. Secondly, we don't have a vision which unites the more credible progressive elements in the sort of centre-left, if you like, of of the global justice movement. We have a very organisationally disparate movement there, split amongst NGOs, amongst political parties, trade unions, think tanks, many of whom are engaged in a very intense institutional rivalry with each other for political influence, for membership, for support and donation. And as a result of that, we have this welter of single issues, all campaigning for press attention, all campaigning for grassroots support, instead of having one sustaining vision which attempts to draw these single issues under a broader hope for the future, a broader umbrella of a vision. And then finally, I don't think we've come up with a vision which explains to affluent people in the northern countries why it is it's in their interest to seek change to the global economy and global policy more generally. Most of the movement today, not entirely, but pretty largely, has built its appeal to northern countries on the basis of altruism. It said, look at these people in the south and developing countries, their lives are being ruined by policies your governments promote. You need to take action against these governments to bring about a better life for these people in the south. Now that will certainly bring about a certain degree of support, but ultimately, real movements which are rooted, deeply rooted in community, in communities throughout the north, will be based also, in addition to that, on sectional self-interest. If you look at the most successful movement of the 20th century, the socialist and social democratic and labour movements, they managed to combine very effectively this idealistic, altruistic vision of socialist change with the sectional of the industrial working classes. And it was that combination that sustained and inspired the movement, but at the same time rooted it in real economic and political power. And that's a leap that I think the global justice movement as yet has not been able to make. Now, the work that I've been doing at the Fabian Society and work that's going on within organisations like the Party of European Socialists, for example, it is starting to try and build this credible vision of global change. And at the Fabian Society, we've argued for it to have four pillars. And I won't go through these in detail, I'll just mention very briefly. The four pillars of change we've called for are global democracy, more global regulation of corporate activity, a global redistribution of wealth, so some more rigid system than the aid system to try and redistribute certain amounts of wealth from north to south, and a more equitable system of trade. And I think for northern populations, the key one of those pillars is regulation, the closer regulation of corporate activity. And I think primarily that's because possibly the key issue which is now confronting many people in the G8 wealthy countries is their declining quality of life, in particular in relation to overwork, the number of hours they now have to work, the lack of time employees increasingly have in their family and for free time, an increasing loss of job security as employers find it increasingly easy simply to shift production centres around the world, and an overall decline in working conditions. And this is something that has really come home to specifically in the United Kingdom in the last 20 years, but I think is increasingly taking hold across Europe. And the movement needs to explain to northern populations that this declining quality of life results from the fact that corporations have increasingly escaped national regulatory frameworks by being able to globalise their activities and play one government off against another. This is why, for example, the current Labour government is so keen to maintain labour market flexibility. This is there's a lot of talk about the difference between Brown and Blair, but the thing that fundamentally unites them is a belief in labour market flexibility, because they know that when you're competing with local investment, that's one of the key ways you attract corporate investment into Britain and they're terrified that if we have control over working hours and working conditions, it will scare investment away. But the only effective way now to regulate corporations is at the global level. It can't be done at the national level anymore because it's too easy for corporations to play one country government off against another. We need to focus on global regulation. And I don't think that's the whole story that can be told by the global justice movement to northern populations, but I think it's maybe a starting point for thinking through, I think, some of these very pressing issues if the movement is really to go into the next stage of being a really influential organisation.
Thank you very much. We have heard a range of views, and I'm sure it has sparked an urge to engage in debate among many of you. Before I open the floor for discussion, can I please ask you to keep your questions very short and say to whom you're asking the question. There are two microphones, I believe, downstairs and one upstairs, so wait for the microphone before you speak. Thank you. Yes.
Well, you were talking about free trade all the time. I would like just to know, where is the room of fair trade? Fair trade as being, as a way of protect human rights, as a way of protect people from developing countries and keep them alive in the market.
Yes, okay. There was one question over there.
That were interested if they could define what they thought the global justice movement was. I've heard a number of different terms used, anti-capitalist, anti-globalization, anti-corporate globalization. Do you think it's an actual entity, or is it a number of movements, and who is in the movement? How would you actually define it?
Thank you. One hand over there. Yes.
Good evening. See, as far as the civilized Western world is concerned, every evil could be solved by tackling Osama bin Laden, and that, therefore there is a Guantanamo Bay. So whereas we think that, the human beings think that, as this Fabian rightly said, the GI, of course I call them the greedy eight leaders, they are responsible for all the evils of this world. So what would, of course we cannot, there is none, you got access to Gordon Brown. So what would he do? Because you people in Britain, forget about the greedy, Britain is the only nation which is responsible for almost all of the evils. In the Commonwealth. So what would, so now you think the favor, okay, we have a new Labour, so you are coming to the election. What would this Howard Dean or Senator Edward, just like you people, you blame Bin Laden, I blame your leaders.
Okay, can you ask your question,
they do?
Please?
And if through United Nations, Kofi Annan, how could he control?
Yeah. Thank you. One question.
Actually, question for the first and last speakers. As far as I see it, neither governments nor producers see a reason to change the status quo. Is there not a sense that we, the consumers, are actually colluding by not being more active in rejecting what is the status quo, in fact?
Thank you. Shall we try to address some of these questions now? Who would like to start? There was one question, the last one, which was to the first and to the last speaker. So.
Well, okay, I'll try to focus on the second question too, defining the global justice movement, since this is what I was trying to do in the chapter. Since we write about it, obviously we do believe it exists, and we view it in very broad terms. And we actually call it, from the first chapter onwards, we call it the anti-capitalist movement. And it involves a very broad range of activists with different positions. And I think what they all share in common is that they question two issues. What are the borders of the market? And could market relations be extended? How far could market relations be extended into the spheres of human life?
and relations? Can we, you know, how far can private property and free exchange, market exchange, be extended? Can it cover health and education? Can it cover defense? Can it cover? Yeah. So, what are the borders of the market? Is one of the main questions of what I define as an anti-capitalist movement. And the second question is, which is something that Razin touched upon, which is it's a belief that markets can fail. It's not necessarily a belief that markets have to fail or do fail, but there's a belief that markets can fail. And then the question that arises out of that is how and who should intervene. So these are the two questions that unite activists who are involved in this broad, very broad and diverse global justice movement. So we identify three or four broad trends in that movement between the rejections or what some call abolitionists, reformers, and there are also a broad group in this movement who we call supporters, who actually, you know, come very close to believing in the fact that markets are perfect. They just allow for minor adjustments that are needed here and there by global institutions. Obviously, people like Razin will not be part of the global justice movement, but everybody to the left could. Consumers colluding by active, obviously this is part. I mean, part of the global justice movement or anti-capitalist movement is by trying to invite consumers to participate in it by deciding how they consume. And what to consume and so on. And there's a very broad range of movement success, especially in the current anti-capitalist movement, in influencing consumer behavior, whether it's regarding fair trade coffee or whether it's regarding organic produce, which is also happens to be more closely produced, as in to address the issue of food miles, if you like, and many other issues. I mean, a big part of the current anti-capitalist movement, as we know it today, is about lifestyle and behavior, and as such, many of the proponents of that movement follow that. Thanks.
Can I say something on this question of fair trade rather than free trade? I think one of the big splits that is actually not always a helpful split in the global justice movement is this issue of markets. And I think one of the big problems is a lot of misunderstanding about markets. I, Oxfam, many of the people campaigning aren't against markets. Markets are everywhere, let's be honest. They're in every village, they're part of life. Markets aren't the problem. But markets are seen by some people as this somehow sacred institution that just works by the laws of economics. They're not. They're social and political institutions like many other things. And they can be manipulated like social and political institutions. So the issue in markets isn't about markets. Nothing wrong with markets. The issue is the power in markets. And one of the big problems in global markets and why we're dealing with a new phenomenon when we're looking globally is if you actually look at, say, in the UK, how markets work, yes, there's sometimes real problems, take the supermarkets, but there are competition laws, there are social safety nets that guarantee people's incomes and ability to participate in those markets, there are there are reinvestment in certain regions, there's whole lots of mechanisms that actually deal with some of the market problems or market imperfections. Globally, we haven't got any of those. And so one of the things we just haven't got to is this idea that somehow you can just let free markets reign and everything will be okay. It's for the birds. Because I worked, for instance, a long time ago on South Korea with the World Bank of all places. And there, they didn't just go into immediately going open. They did a huge amount of import substitution. They subsidized certain industries. They export promoted, and then they went open. So the idea that you can go open before you've built up your power base, before you've done all sorts of other things to your institutional base, that's where we get into muddles. The idea that it's okay to have national monopoly control, but actually you can't possibly think about it at the global level. You know, sorry, we're dealing in a global world with many things that global. We've got to have the global institutions that follow. And the idea that you can duck that is just the same as going back 5 centuries and complaining about what the king's doing, you know, and you can't have national government. We all know we've got to go the next mile. And we've got to have a system that works at both the global level for those things that are global and it works at the local level for those things that are local. And that's where the future lies.
Thank you.
Well, let me pick up on the lady's question over there on fair trade. Part of the problem is the terminology, because one could say this term fair trade is akin to mother's milk, social justice, global governance, civil society even. It's in the eye of the beholder. It means different things to different people. We know pretty much what free trade means. But if you're President Bush, or before him President Clinton, or the Association of Steel Manufacturers in the United States, or Korean farmers associations, fair trade is the justification of all kinds of skullduggery in the form of protection against often poor people abroad, because they're the ones who are engaging in unfair trade. Now, the Oxfam version, and I will go some of the way with the Oxfam version, is that unfair trade is what is done by the North to the detriment, especially of those who are poor, weak, and vulnerable in the third world. So there is no agreed definition or interpretation of what constitutes fair trade. My simple answer is that, broadly speaking, free trade is fair trade. You would expect me to say that. But I would do so for the following reasons. You mentioned human rights and a whole host of other objectives in the same breath as fair trade. I think it is highly unadvisable to lump all of these objectives into the trade equation. What often happens when people talk about other objectives, laudable objectives, such as human rights, conditions of work, the environment, and then brings in the threat of trade protectionism, is that, firstly, it is counterproductive. It actually harms the people you're trying, or you're supposed to be trying to help. And secondly, it opens the door to all the wrong interested parties who will use these sentimental arguments for their own interested purposes. It is better, I think, to deal with all kinds of other issues on other agendas through other forums, mainly at the national level, sometimes at the international level, but stick to narrower ground on trade. Now, to pick up the point made just a moment ago about the free market utopia, of course, free markets in vacuo are utopian everywhere in the world. The United States is not a utopian free market, far from it. Different countries have different ways of regulating markets. By and large, we have more regulation, including competition policy and safety nets, in the West than in the third world. But let me take issue here. I don't think it's right in terms of the historical evidence that countries that have succeeded have waited until everything else is in place before they've opened. That wasn't even the case with Korea. There have been huge differences across the world, but one of the main stories of East Asian success is openness. Yes, some countries have employed industrial policy highly selectively, Korea and Taiwan more, certainly, than Hong Kong and others. But they opened to the world while other developing countries didn't. That was one reason for their success. Another point where I would take issue with the Oxfam version. I'm glad that Oxfam has finally come around to accepting markets. If you look at some of the Oxfam literature, going back to the 60s and 70s, you will see a much more extremist and Neanderthalic version of how markets work than is the case today. So there is some progress after all. And a lot of what was said a moment ago, I happen to agree with. I disagree on this one point. The Oxfam version, for example, in its report that came out last year, is rather Manichaean. It grudgingly accepts the reality and the expansion of markets in developing countries, but it points to all the faults in the West. those faults should be pointed out. And Oxfam does the world a service when, along with the G20, it points to the scandalous agricultural protection we have in Europe, the United States, and elsewhere, when it brings up issues such as cotton, which are perfectly legitimate, when it points out what damage it does to poor people in poor countries. What Oxfam glosses over are the criminal or quasi-criminal rackets that exist within developing countries themselves. I mean, the evidence here is overwhelming. The main damage done to people in vulnerable conditions in developing countries, whether it be in agriculture or in manufacturing or in services, happens to come from their own governments. And the evidence from the World Bank and others shows very clearly the countries that actually liberalize the most themselves gain the most, and that much of the gain from a potential big package in the Doha round, which doesn't look like eventuating anytime soon, will come, yes, a lot of it will come from northern liberalization in agriculture, textiles and clothing and what have you, but more of the gain for developing countries actually comes from developing countries liberalizing markets vis-a-vis each other. It is scandalous when you look at the way the Indians, for example, protect their markets against textiles exports from Bangladesh, or what the Brazilians do with other Latin American countries. If you had a lot of that trade freed up, and that is not part of the G20 agenda, and it's not part of a lot of the ideology that comes out from NGOs, you would be doing, especially the poorer countries, a service, because they would have an outlet to more advanced developing country markets. A word on consumers. A lot of the consumer calls for consumer boycotts, I think, are ill-advised, or at least not thought through. For example, when you try and promote fair trade, labeling is fine. You want to pinpoint malpractices and skullduggery by certain firms in other parts of the world. That's fine. But what is not often thought through is the knock-on effects that has for people really at the vulnerable end. So what do you do when you have a consumer, well-organized consumer boycott in the West against, I don't know, so-called unfair coffee from other parts of the world? Who suffers most? I mean, just think of that. One positive way in which Western consumers can make a difference is when they, through their associations, such as the Consumers Association in the UK, and I know the chap who's organizing this, try to form alliances with developing country producers. So there are instances, for example, of consumers associations, those who are actually interested in markets and making a difference in the third world, trying to form alliances with developing country producers, for example, of canned fish, and taking cases to the WTO where there are clear instances of developed countries using all the wrong sorts, all the dubious sorts of regulation, food safety measures and what have you, to prevent developing country producers from exporting to developed countries. I mean, there's one way in which consumers in the West can make a positive difference.
Thank you. Any other comments from the panel?
Can I just say something? I apologize, because I know I'm stopping people from the floor having their say, but I just wanted to just very quickly just take issue with this idea that there is overwhelming historical evidence for free trade and openness being the main cause of economic development. I mean, most free marketeers steer well clear of the history and rely on theoretical models and econometrics, because the history simply doesn't uphold the argument. The work that's been done recently by people like Harjun Chang at Cambridge have shown very clearly that developing countries from Britain right through to Taiwan have developed through a very complex and sophisticated mix of infant industry protection and a very gradual process of liberalization, which I think is partly what you were saying anyway. But if you're saying that, why put all the emphasis on free trade and not on this more complex, sophisticated mix of the two?
Thank you.
Can I come back quickly? No, that's a fair point. I think those who would be simplistic about it and point to free trade as a panacea clearly have got, I think they've got their theory wrong, but they've also got their history wrong. Because the crucial link is between what you do on trade, on foreign investment, and also, one shouldn't forget, free trade is also about the movement of people, or at least that was the 19th century version. We've conveniently forgotten about that through the 20th century. And that includes also developing countries opening their markets to people from other developing countries. But I mean, that's a digression. The crucial, where the real gains have come, this would be my reading of the historical evidence, is when there is a significant opening to trade, and that does mean freer markets, but when that is combined with an improvement of the domestic institutional stuffing, as it were. And that includes all kinds of difficult things, like getting rid of your crooks and thugs to begin with in government. Like having clean, efficient public administration, enforcement of property rights and contracts, education, transport, other forms of infrastructure. And the two mix well over time. But this, of course, is easier said than done. And these combinations, how fast, how slow you go, what kind of mix, differ from country to country. And I'm quite happy with that. I don't think, on the whole, infant industry protection has worked in Britain or in most other places. One can point to instances here and there, but I think that's the exception, not the rule. At the end of the day, there is a highly differentiated picture, but trade is an important part of that equation. Whether it's the main part or not is, I think, difficult to pin down. In some cases, yes. In other cases, perhaps less so.
Thank you. There was a question.
Yes, I was just very interested to ask all the members of the panel what their analysis of this time last year, this country and 600 cities around the world were organizing for the biggest resistance in terms of the war against Iraq. And I wondered, in terms of your analysis, what impact you saw in relation to that.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to know your views on, as far as the global justice movement goes, will it make any difference as to who's sitting in the White House in January next year?
Thank you. Gentleman here. Can you wait for the microphone?
Yes, hello. Yeah, I was just wondering, for the historical record, what's the role of imperialism and colonialism to help develop certain northern states?
Thank you. We have time for another. Do you want the question repeated? Or? No, okay. Two hands there. Yes.
Thanks very much. I had kind of a naive question for Mr. Adam Lent. I agree very much with your second pillar, calling for the global regulation of corporate activity, especially in the North. That is certainly a seminal question. Ambrose Bierce defined a corporation as an ingenious mechanism for securing individual profit while avoiding all individual responsibility. How does your organization propose to rein in such a formidable sector of the political system in today's global economy, and certainly and especially in the United States?
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, to Adam Lent, again, you spoke about how there was a lack of vision, but between kind of linking up kind of exploited workers in the North and exploited workers in the South. But the ideas of Michael Albert and Paracon have been ignored by kind of, let's say, reformist agendas. And there, I think there's a start for kind of supposed localization and a new way forward, communal way forward. I wonder if you have any ideas about Michael Albert.
Thank you. And one last question from gentleman over there.
What surprises me is the fact that we sort of tend to lose sight of the fact that once any organization or any person has got power, within that power lies all the possibilities to do good and bad at the same time. So we're listening to this debate, and we see you knocking the Osbaum's point of view for equality, and then same time you point to some negative elements, lack of property rights, crooks, political countries, other countries. You know all these. But you see, what we tend to forget is you don't have monopoly over wisdom. We know when you're trying to be slick or dubious by not being genuinely sincere about your pronouncements and things. So there isn't ever going to be equality. People in power do not really stand up. They tend to be hypocritic. They know the good, they have the power, they just misuse it. And that is what some other people are trying to fight against. People don't expect to support crooks in government, but it is the people with power in the West who do sort of colonize them, and we know this. So where do you stand when you try to stand on forums like this and try to propagate the power of free trade, liberalization, and all that, when we know that at the same time you do other things that we see that are not very helpful, yet you try to support them on forums, just to be sincere?
Thank you. Thank you. Can I ask members of the panel to be as brief as possible because it's 10 to 8 and we're supposed to end by 8 o'clock. Who would like to start?
I'll just be very brief. I think the question was, how does it matter who sits in the White House for the global justice movement? Is that the question? Well, it does matter in terms of tactics. It obviously doesn't matter in terms of strategy, but when you have an administration in the White House who is more committed to multilateral solutions, who is left of center, democratic administration, who is open to dialogue with a whole set of world leaders and representatives of civil society, and when you have an administration that is openly, blatantly pursuing a narrow interpretation of U.S. national interests, like the Bush administration, obviously you need different tactics with different administrations. The same thing is about the Washington consensus. I was very heartened by Razin's attack on the Washington consensus, because that means it's definitely dead. It's definitely time for the anti-capitalist movement to move on from the Washington consensus. I mean, they have been beating a dead horse for a couple of years now. I wanted to come back actually to one other issue that was not in this last round of questions, but in the previous one, about the anti-capitalist movement and a couple of statements that were raised here about global civil society. The anti-capitalist movement is by nature global, actually. There is very little in terms of what happens in the global justice movement, anti-capitalist movement, that is national or nation-based. It's arisal. The most interesting part of it is an appreciation of the need of collective global action on all these issues. And this also conflicts something that Adam mentioned about it, which is its failure to inspire, if you like, Western electorates. As a matter of fact, most of the activists in the movement from Northern NGOs are not, in fact, acting out of benevolent solidarity feelings. That was the case in the 70s and 80s. Actually, most of them are acting on behalf of themselves as well as on behalf of the Southerners. They view the movement as a way of gaining a voice. Many of the young people you see demonstrating in Seattle and Prague are not really doing that out of benevolent feelings toward the South, but as a way of gaining a right to political self-expression for the first time. These are people who have been written out of the political equation of the electoral political process, and have actually, through the global justice movement, found a way to express themselves and join the political process. The question about the Iraq War, I mean, it's I'm not sure what was that question about, but it is interesting actually that the anti-war movement was fed. I mean, as the muscle or main kind of the meat of the movement came from the anti-capitalist movement. But as I mentioned, there's quite a tension between and carries many of its problems. This is why I was bringing examples from the anti-war demonstration to talk about the anti-capitalist movement. There's lots of overlap. I mean, in this country, it was globalized resistance that organized the anti-war march and did a lot of organization. But there's a schizophrenia there, because the marches and the anti-war movement in Iraq was calling for more multilateralism, while the work on trade and other issues is descending into full rejection of multilateralism, a tension that will have to be addressed. Thank you.
I'm not going to give you my views on Iraq from a layman's point of view, of course, but I think that there are clearly linkages with everything else. Those who do not realize that U.S. trade policy under this administration and even a Democrat administration come next year is security policy are fooling themselves. I mean, the United States views trade policy and everything else through that security prism after September the 11th. And that has all kinds of huge ramifications. There is an analogy here. I think on the broader high politics agenda, multilateralism here and there is important, but fundamentally what matters is the leadership of the United States and genuine coalitions of the willing or alliances, as opposed to one-way coalitions of the willing. I think that applies to trade policy and the WTO. The WTO is only going to work post-Cancun. It's only not going to be sidelined if it stops taking an extended vacation from reality and works with the grain of prevailing power realities. That means U.S. leadership, and it means coalitions of the willing. Without U.S. leadership, the WTO is not going to work. And it will only work if the U.S. forges the right sort of alliances on market access, not with the European Union, which is a problem, and not with Japan, which is a problem, but with key developing countries. And those are many of the G20 majors, South Africa, Brazil, India eventually after the election perhaps, and crucially China. China is the best news there is in the WTO and has been for some time. China is behaving in a very adult and business-like way. It's interested in market access. It's not interested in silly games like most developing countries in the WTO. Over time, and there are all the signs of this happening in terms of the background noise, there is the possibility of a strategic partnership between the United States and China, which I think would be very good news on both high and low politics agendas. What about the White House next year? Well, I'm saddened to say that the bipartisan consensus on sort of free-ish trade, you know, with lots of ifs and buts, has broken down. The sad fact of U.S. trade policy is that something that, for all its faults, in terms of Mr. Bush not being a genuine free trader, and this really being very, very low down his list of priorities, of short-term protectionist politics and what have you, the sad fact is that it would probably be worse with a Democrat in the White House and Democrat majorities in the Congress, because the Democrat Party has turned to protection. And even centrist Democrats, like Mr. Lieberman, would have to pander to both the sentimental and the unsentimental enemies of an open United States to a greater extent than President Bush and Republican majorities in the Senate and the House, which is why if I were to vote in November, I would vote Republican down the line, you know, with all the qualifications. Not on this issue. I mean, on macroeconomic policy, I think it's insane. And with important ramifications for the world economy, and also provides all the ground for Hillary Clinton's candidacy in 2008, the success of which I would find aesthetically somewhat displeasing. Imperialism. I think that the record of imperialism, of colonialism, is highly mixed. It's pretty bad with the non-British empires. And one can think of an extreme example, which is what the Belgians did in the Congo. The legacy, the reality of which we still see today. For all the faults of the British Empire, there are lots of positive stories to tell about countries getting on that first ladder of development, the first rung of the ladder, because of their contact with the advanced centers of commerce of ideas in the West that came through imperialism. It was a worse record in some places, in parts of Africa. It was considerably better in others. The British record in my own country of Sri Lanka, Ceylon, as it used to be, is on the whole pretty good in terms of what it did for development in Ceylon before independence. The same is true for Malaya. It's true for Hong Kong and Singapore, and it is actually true for India as well. And one shouldn't forget, shouldn't forget that. Finally, I am not interested particularly in, you know, insane rhapsodies and sophomoric rants. I'm interested in presenting my case as I see it, and thinking of practical ways of going about it in a real messy world out there, as opposed to, you know, the blackboards and the computer modeling in the ivory tower. And what I see from within the ivory tower are sometimes the most unlikely alliances. You know, one sees alliances between politicians indulging in realpolitik in the West and crooks and thugs in the third world. But one also sees alliances, witting or unwitting, between the various denizens of international organizations and various NGOs, I might add, with all the wrong sorts of people in developing countries. If one is going to apportion blame, one should do it liberally.
Can, just to add slightly different slant on this whole question of colonialism and materialism, I'm not going to deny for a second there weren't some positive and altruistic sides to colonialism, but if you look at the basic model going back, a lot of it was extractive. A lot of it was set up to get products cheaply to fuel the industries of the North. And then you have to ask yourself, however you call it, how come almost every market, whether you're looking at the coffee market or many of the other markets, you're seeing the share of producers and the actual, you know, most prices, most coffee farmers are getting half what they were getting 5 years ago. Same across almost every other market, apart from the situation you get in, which is still where farmers are screwed, but in the situation of markets where northern countries also produce sugar, cotton, those types of markets, then you see a different rhetoric to free markets. You see, let's protect and let's keep our markets, you know, and I'd agree with you on the issues, but there's such hypocrisy here around what's happening, which is still actually a colonial legacy, because people aren't prepared to deal with the power issues in those markets and set up a world, which we could easily have, where we've got enough resources to deal with poverty globally, and we're just not prepared to deal with it because those people out there are in nation states, and actually we can't get our act together globally. It's a disgrace. And just finally, this issue of the anti-war movement, just a couple of points on that. I see that being tremendous energy, but we have to ask ourselves, how come there's such energy for those movements, and yet only 50% of people are likely to vote in the US election? Britain, it's dismal at local level. It might be a bit better nationally. There's such distrust, not just of politicians in developing countries. I think we should be very careful how many stones we throw there. Look at the level of distrust, any poll, of our politicians, and ask ourselves, why are people so disenfranchised from representative democracy? And yes, we're trying to, you know, there's this move to replace it with participatory democracy, but actually we've got to make that system work. We've got. And what's gone wrong that we're not? So I think there's some big questions for us there, all of us.
Just to speed things up, because we're right at the end now, I'll give my answer in the form of a website. In relation to the question on global regulation, there's a new alliance of NGOs and other organizations campaigning for more corporate regulation called CORE, C-O-R-E. I think their website is www.core.org.uk. And they're developing new models and ways of approaching corporate regulation at a global level that will hopefully prove more successful than the current models we have.
Thank you. It's my duty to officially close this evening. We have heard a range of views and proved, I suppose, that the agenda is still open for debate. And I hope I share your view that tonight we have contributed a little bit in that direction. Let me thank our speakers for an excellent discussion.